Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer. Does my nose look better this way or that way, Williams?
Okay, well, that's a real deep cut to this movie we're talking about today.
Exactly. I mean, people won't get it now, but once they get into the movie, they'll be like, oh, that's what he was talking about. And speaking of additions to the body of this podcast, we got with us part-timer slash stenographer slash part-timer. Did I say part-timer twice?
Yes.
Okay. So, intern slash part-timer slash stenographer slash coffee bringer brings no coffee slash I need to be nicer to slash Ensign Amy has returned.
I still maintain my rank, Captain Spencer.
That's because there's a plan for you to die at the end of this season.
You're a red shirt.
I don't want to be a red shirt. Scalzi told me not to be.
We got a great show in store as we kick off the spooky season of October with our first look at the mastermind Guillermo del Toro's iconic work in Kronos. So stick around as we talk about that. But before we do, Spencer, give them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check out all of our episodes over at our website at filmlosophers.com. We got over 300 episodes, allegedly, on everything just about from sci-fi to fantasy to romance to conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Check us out at our website, filmlosophers.com. You can also find us on any app that streams podcasts, such as iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, iHeart, TuneIn. You can tune in to wherever your heart's desire and find us there. Look up The Filmlosophers, give us a follow, give us a subscribe, and let us know how we're doing. Give us a 5-star review. We've earned it. We've had a great run of Star Trek this past month, and we are well into the new month of October, and we are excited to get into that. And of course, as I stated before, socials will be given to you at the end. We are well into this new month, this wonderful month, where it always seems acceptable every day. I swear I can talk. It seems acceptable every day to watch scary movies. And there's no month like it, to be honest. I mean, you could be like every other normal person like that and watch horror movies all year long. But there's just something special about watching a scary movie during the month of October that just makes it seem more holiday-esque. I don't know. We have a little bit of a issue, so to speak. Not issue in... Well, I guess it could be an issue. Intern Amy has the big issue of just being petrified even before seeing the movie for fear that she'll turn whiter than she already is.
Oh, thanks. It's just because I haven't been tanning and the sun goes down a lot sooner now.
But it's interesting because you're very big on like the movie we're going to talk about. You're big on like fairy tales and aspects like that. You just don't like jump scares. Is that what I'm assuming?
Yes, that, and I was with Spencer for something. We were watching something and I came across and I said, I do not like body horror.
Well, it was Star Trek. The last one, the, Star Trek, not First Contact.
Oh yeah. With the Borg.
Yeah, with the Borg.
With the Borg. Or we mentioned there, and I was like, oh, no.
Yes.
Yeah. So I have come to, by the slower exposure of various suspense and or horror films, come to find out I do not like body horror. I do not like house horror, i.e. you're trapped in house and your safe space is violated thing. So I had a difficulty watching Us, but I did it. I still did it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, jump scares, after that one fateful Friday the 13th, where I watched Friday the 13th for the very first time, I did not know about the ending. I did not know Spencer. Spencer, I did not know. I jumped so high and threw a blanket over my head and turned a shade of white that would be akin to, as I am told, sugar. Domino sugar.
What is domino sugar?
There's like CNH sugar and sugar and what's the crystal?
Crystal sugar? You're talking to two people who just use sugar. Either it comes in a packet or it comes in a container.
Well, I know there's like Dixie, but there's lots of different sugars anyway. So I was really white and no, I cannot do it.
One of the things that I'm like uber proud about while doing this show is, I guess you could say, the indoctrination of Spencer into...
I don't know if indoctrination.
It was because it sounds sketchy.
I know.
It is because of the fact that for the longest, Spencer was very against horror movies, not for the same reasons you were. He wasn't, you know, scaredy cat.
I'm okay to be a scaredy cat. Sometimes we're safer that way.
No, he was. It was more of a sense for Spencer. Why don't you explain it, Spence?
Well, okay, basically, I was tired of yelling at people not to go into the garage. You know something's out there. Why are you going out there? Ridiculous. I want to see smart people in a horror movie, mm-hmm. and then they face off something. And that's when I started to get into it, because you knew the ones that were right up my alley. And I was like, I like these ones.
Yeah. And it is like, it's one of those instances where, much like regular filmmaking, like the general audience is, there is a difference between smart filmmaking and just literally mind-numbing ridiculousness. We're looking at you, Vin Diesel. It's one of those situations where it's like you could get a really smart, a really intelligent, really well-written film, something that is verbose and has a ton of like witty screenwriting and so forth. And then you can get something like from Uwe Boll that just... completely destroys all of the senses because it makes no sense whatsoever.
And then when you critique his film, he comes and beats you up.
Yes, or he...
Only on the internet. No,
literally. He actually did a thing where he was in a boxing ring and offered to fight the critics that spoke out against his movies to give them a chance to, you know, fight it out.
It actually happened.
And the interesting thing
is... This is where we need to have video because no one can see my mouth agape and wide-eyed like stare at like, Spencer, is this really doing? Like, yes, it's real.
It's true. And the thing is that a lot of the press thought it was just kind of like a press event. Like it was something like a joke. And
they showed up.
Uwe Boll... No. They showed up thinking, oh, lighthearted kind of thing. Think Rocky 3. Remember when he and Hulk Hogan and they're like, oh, it's a fun event, you know, we're just here for the kids, blah 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 blah, and he thunderlipped the crap out of him and decided that he was going to go for blood with film critics. This actually happened, and Uwe Boll, no. You need help. I believe half the internet can agree with us.
I better be careful. He'll try to fight you.
I think I'm blocked by him still.
I forgot.
I was blocked by Uwe Boll because there was a whole thing not too long ago. Story for another day. But it's one of those things where there's like smart movies and there's like dumb movies. And same thing with every genre. I mean, you can get lazy movies and you can get smart, well-done movies. Same thing with horror. You can have very intelligent, very smart, very thought-provoking type of horror. Take, for instance, things like Shutter Island, which isn't so much of a horror, but it's like a psychological thriller. Shutter Island is a very smart movie. It's a very in-depth film. And then turn it around and you have Fast and the Furious 8. Or 7, or whichever ones that there are, they're getting chased by submarines. For God knows, like
I think that's 8. I think.
I don't even know. I lost count.
It's Fast and Furious.
He swings his car with a broken down rope bridge. Like he catches the wheel well with the rope that's broken, and he swings around.
It's Fast and Furious Infinity Sign.
Yeah, pretty much.
Infinite loop.
That's an understatement. But yeah, when it comes to like horror movies. there are just exactly like Spencer said, those ones that people are yelling at the screen, the things that people have made stereotypes and tropes in movies, like, oh my God, he's coming in the room, he's right there, like people yelling in theaters, the movies that give you the most obvious instances where you know common sense says to go the other direction and the character goes in that direction, and it's usually some big-chested blonde person who gets killed for like one of the most gruesome yet somehow still seductive scenes. And I think that's kind of the interesting perspective of with horror, that even in this genre where like most of the community is very much, you know, oh, you know, we're kind of in a field of our own, it can still be divided, much like any other genre out there.
True.
So yeah, I spent a good amount of time just combing through movies and trying to find the right ones for Spencer. And if you want to know what that was like, we actually recorded those instances a couple years back. I even forget what episodes those were. But it was great and it was fun. And yeah, I think we may need to do that for Amy.
Oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
If not this year, maybe plan for it next year. Uh-uh. Yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. It'll be fun. But
it'll be fun. She's sitting on the couch, rocking back and forth, crying, going, "I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. I can't do it. I can't do it.
It'll be fun.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine." And the long drawn out fine. Censor. No.
Well, speaking of smart horror movies, that leads us to today's review as we dive deep into Guillermo del Toro's first feature-length film that was released, I believe it was released in theaters as well, 1993's Kronos. This movie is a quintessential film from the iconic filmmaker that has really been one of those hidden gems of his repertoire. Not a lot of people know about it.
It's in the Criterion Collection.
Well, now, but prior to, like, and even now, not a lot of people know of the film. They just know, just because a movie's in the Criterion Collection does not mean it's well known. It just means that it has hit and gone above and beyond the standard of filmmaking for this type of filmmaking. So, as we dive in, before we dive in, actually, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Antique dealer Jesus Gris stumbles upon Kronos, a 400-year-old scarab that, when latches onto him, grants him youth and eternal life, but also a thirst for blood. As Jesus enjoys his newfound vitality, he is unaware that a dying old man, Dieter de la Guardia, has sent his nephew, Angel, to find the scarab and bring it back to him. But Jesus will not give immortality up easily, even risking the life of his orphan granddaughter.
Directed by, as we stated, the enigmatic Guillermo del Toro, the film stars Federico Lupi, Tamara Shanath, Margarita Isabel, Claudio Brook, and Ron Perlman. A couple key pieces of trivia for the film. The two De La Guardia characters were deliberately intended to be somewhat unreal. Like comic book characters, Guillermo del Toro explains in his commentary that he did this as a sort of revenge against Hollywood films about having Mexican characters that are rather stereotypical. You know, the mustache twirling type of individuals. Most of the villains in most of those films are either someone of dark skin. When you come to like the turn of the century where like Mexico is close by, you have the Mexican fiends and things like that. So it makes sense to make the American characters as such. The director, Guillermo del Toro, started writing on the script as early as 1984, where it was initially titled Vampire of the Grey Dawn, which is interesting because it kind of lends itself to the idea of like gray, aging, older, dawn, the new, you know, rebirth, so to speak. But it's very interesting. And last but not least, sadly, all of the original Kronos devices created for the film were stolen when production was completed. They were never recovered, so the Kronos devices that Guillermo del Toro owns are actual replicas from the original molds, which art designer Maria Figueroa created. It's unfortunate because those designs, like that little Scarab itself is so beautiful, mm-hmm. like for the film and for the mechanisms and the way it works. So it's sad that he doesn't have any of the original devices, but I was thinking about it. It'd be a really great, like one of those documentaries where somebody takes on the tasks to go and find the originals.
Like Narvar and that VHS for Snoop Dogg, for his like first VHS.
That is literally a pull out of left field.
It's what I thought
of. Nardwar.
Nardwar. See, oh, but he got it.
She said Nardwar.
At least I didn't say Narvar.
That's the French version of Nardwar. Nardwar. Speaking about this film, we're going to be deep diving into this. Everybody here got a chance to see it. It is available currently on HBO Max. But this was an interesting film that I wanted to pull because of the fact that looking at the history and the filmography of Guillermo del Toro, it is true. This is his first feature-length film. He had done a couple shorts prior to, not to mention all the unknown or unreleased footage or films that he has done on his own time. This is one of the first ones that's been in theaters at full feature length. But it's a very unique story for somebody to take their first film and it be something as unique as this. It's on the verge of being a vampire film, but at the same time, it's on the verge of being like this gothic fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And so I guess starting out this review, I wanted to ask your guys' opinions on where your film experience in vampire films lies. Just because we talk about eternal youth, we talk about immortality, we talk about the necessity of needing blood to survive, that lends itself a little bit to the vampire mythos. So let's kind of start there, and I want to see where you guys go with that. Let's start with you, Amy.
Well, I'd like to point out that we've actually already talked about this topic on episode 308, where we did a review of Nosferatu, and I went into almost mostly depth about I had seen vampire stuff, and then I vaguely remembered it, and things much like the trivia night for Twilight. I'm sorry, Spencer, that you had to subject yourself to that at the Therum Back Cafe. So I've seen what we had this conversation, and I'm gonna get like picked on, but I've seen Interview with the Vampire, Nosferatu, the Dracula with Gary Oldman.
Let me change this up then. Since we have done this one, then let me ask you this: what are your thoughts on the vampire mythos? What are your thoughts on the idea of, you know, a creature of the night who, because a lot of people look at it and they take a look at Bram Stoker's original works, they look at Anne Rice's work, and you look at a lot of these, and the basis for a lot of the character makeup does tend to lend itself more to the sexuality of the human mind itself, and as well as the body. But others look at it as kind of like this movie, as a grasp at the what ifs. If man could achieve immortality and what that cost would look like. What do you feel like in terms of when you think about the vampire mythos?
Well, as a whole, I've always kind of felt that the vampire mythos, especially more so when I was growing up, was steeped in that the... I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this. That it was more geared or focused towards not only just sexuality, but it was decadence. It was the lusts of the flesh. Like that was always how it was kind of more portrayed versus when you're looking at some other, especially in this movie, but in some other aspects, that it is the grasp or the fear of death. And the what ifs, and not the consumables, but the what ifs of living longer, taking those opportunities. And in regards to that, this has a really great space inside the vampire mythos as it straddles so many lines.
Yeah.
And most of the time, especially with gothic fairy tales, they're cautionary tales of warning. So they do that, and we've seen that with a lot of Guillermo's other work, where he straddles the line of giving warning but also creating and delving into the fantasy of whatever tale he's telling. So I'm going to try to refrain from aggressively going in because I have thoughts about this movie.
I can see that. Spencer, what about you? What are some of your thoughts on like the vampire mythos? Even in film, like, do you feel like vampires are in most like mainstream films, do you think they're properly, I don't want to say represented because they're not people
portrayed,
but are they properly portrayed?
Are they sparkly enough?
Like,
So, in Portrayal, I guess excluding one specific sparkly group, for the most part, yeah. Because I feel like, you know, vampires have a very certain set of recurring abilities and traits that, you know, you can instantly look at and be like, yep, that's a vampire. Sunlight, and you can't come into my house without me saying something. But, yeah, I feel like I have Twilight stuck in my head mostly because of you and those
Hotel
people.
Transylvania?
Looking, you're looking at Amy, by the way, yeah. Not looking at me. Just want to make sure. This is not a video podcast. I need to make sure I lay that down. This is Amy's fault.
But not Hotel Transylvania.
I never seen that one.
Okay. Don't worry. You don't have to.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that it's a really important kind of recognition to have when it comes to the, I guess, original monsters, if you will, of cinema, outside of the, like, the social economical ones or the ones that are mentioned, like, in the mindset of, like, oh, well, man was the monster, and this was, like, I'm talking about, like, in the literal sense, original monsters for cinema. We look at, like, what Universal put forth in creating.
We look at your arm and your tattoos.
Yes, my arm and my tattoos. I have some of the core Universal monsters on my arms, such as Frankenstein, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the Wolfman, Dracula, the Mummy, and the Bride of Frankenstein on my arms at this moment. And it's interesting to see the personification of what people had only read up to at that point in time, taking a little bit, if you will, with the Nosferatu story, because the Nosferatu story isn't exactly a direct adaptation, if you will, of Bram Stoker's work. However, it is still on that level of he is essentially a creature of the night, mm-hmm. otherwise known as a vampire. And we've seen vampires throughout cinema history. We're looking at things like Interview with a Vampire. We're looking at Bram Stoker's Dracula. We're looking at things like even the... oh my God, I almost said the Lost Boys. Lost Boys, yeah.
Lost Boys.
Lost Boys with Kiefer Sutherland in them. You know, even to the extent of movies that are a little bit more modern and take place in a little bit more of a modern setting, if not futuristic, with Ethan Hawke's Daybreakers.
I wanted Queen of the Damned.
Well, Queen of the Damned, but that's still like in a current sense. I mean, like futuristic. Daybreakers takes place in the future.
Not like that Eddie Murphy one.
That was a Brooklyn Interview with a Brooklyn Vampire or something like that.
I don't know.
I forget, but I know which one you're talking about. But no, like Daybreakers takes place in the future where humans and vampires are literally separate societies, and there are essentially the more advanced ones are the vampires.
Oh,
and the,
there's an anime that does something like that too.
Sam Neill plays the head vampire, if you will, in this
really?
One. Yeah, it's a really great movie. But you get a lot of different instances, but the thing that shouldn't really change should be at least the makeup of what the character is. You know, you have somebody who, you know, at one point in time was a human or a mortal and is afflicted somehow or in some way to become a vampire, i.e. if not the titular Dracula, a vampire, so to speak. And then to maintain his immortality has to consume human blood. Hmm. And it's true, like, there is a lot of romanticizing in the original novel as well as Anne Rice's novel. I mean, there's been so many deep dives into the mindset of what it means for what each action that the vampire does or that Dracula does that lends itself more towards, like, oh, this is kind of a little bit more on the side of seduction or decadence. This is on the side of, you know, somebody who is literally sucking on someone's neck, has a sense of sensuality to it. But there's also, like Amy was mentioning, facets of it where the desire for humanity to find a way to never die drives a very strong point in this. You know, you have somebody, you have an entity who is fighting, who is literally going against human nature to maintain, you know, a presence in this current world.
Well, and I think that's also, if we're going to pivot just slightly, especially we're talking about Vampire Mythos, the True Blood series or the Sookie Stackhouse novels, the TV show had kind of different variations on those vampires where, yes, the basis was still there, but there was also one of them, his name, I can't remember the actor's name, but he played Bill Compton, no joke. He was always fighting against he was always fighting against the quote unquote nature of him being a vampire, mm-hmm. Where he had chosen to partake of animal blood. And then when they came out with a synthetic blood, where essentially he could drink blood and not actually drink human blood, he was able to still maintain and connect to his humanity or the moral sense of compass that continued to drive him, mm-hmm. which was interesting also to see in juxtaposition to Brad Pitt's character in Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, yeah. And then you get the Cullens, who are vegans apparently, and mm-hmm. or vegetarians, and that whole movie just changes everything about the vampire mythos, and it just really kind of puts it puts a sour taste for anybody who is a fan of the original story element to it. So Spencer has this face of disgust right now.
It's because, like, I don't care about Twilight, but, like, I saw part of it, and, like, I have questions, but I also don't care about the answers.
I don't either.
Whenever you feel like yelling them at me, I can give you vague answers.
I just want to know why they're sparkly.
No, we don't.
Something with sunlight.
Oh yeah, that answers a lot.
It's so, something like the coming like back stone to, skin something.
Coming back to this movie, Kronos. So, like I said, we all got a chance to see it. I saw this movie a long time ago. I actually rented it from a Blockbuster.
Dang.
And I remember seeing it for the first time, and I had totally different thoughts and mentalities about it then. And then I've seen this movie several times throughout my lifetime. Like, I can at least think of a couple dozen, no joke. Because I love this movie. I love the filmmaker. I love Guillermo del Toro. I have talked about him on this show probably more times than any other director, filmmaker, performer, writer, everything.
Are you going to get his face tattooed on your butt?
Maybe not on my butt, but maybe I'll get his face tattooed on my face.
Oh. Since they're like, okay, good luck with that one. We're going to be over here.
So for you guys, though, this is your first time seeing it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk first impressions right outside the gate of seeing the film. I want to start with Spencer.
Okay, so like I literally looked nothing up about this movie. Uh-huh. I just saw the title. So when it started and like Guillermo del Toro was there, I was like, oh, this is your film? This is awesome already. So I was super jazzed about it at that point. Then also immediately concerned because like I saw a lot of like Spanish at the front, so I was like, oh, let me flip it to Spanish, and it was like, no, English only, no subtitles.
Yeah,
is a lie.
I was freaking out. I'm like, I don't remember the beginning being in English. What is going on?
I know. And then when like that person in like the most bored tone is in English at the beginning, I was like, oh, they're about to ruin this awesome movie, aren't they? But no, it was fine. It was in Spanish despite saying English. It was great. But yeah, after seeing the whole movie, I was like, I like how this vampire movie starts off as not a vampire movie.
Yeah.
That was a cool find.
Yeah.
So I was very, very, very jazzed about this one.
What about you, Ames?
A bit of the same, actually, with Spencer. I too was concerned about the audio going, mm-hmm, like, please, mm-hmm, do not let this be a dub. I cannot handle that. I'm like, after I've seen Guillermo's work, please do not be a dub, please. Initially, I do agree with Spencer in the it's an unexpected vampire story. And it's in a way that's an organically unexpected vampire story that you're like, oh, we've switched gears very quickly. And then I was also kind of sitting with it for a few minutes because there were a lot of other things that I saw that transitioned from it just being like the latter half of the movie being a vampire movie. And I have some deep and slightly mixed emotions about it. It's still wonderful, but things I would like to talk about, please. Okay. Put on your therapy glasses, folks.
For me, like this movie continues to evolve my way of thinking about it. Every time I see it, every viewing of it changes my perspective ever so slightly. And I have gone fully from recognizing that this movie is about Jesus to this movie is about his granddaughter, and recognizing those transitions and those switches, and just really kind of falling in love with, all over again, with the type of storytelling that he does, and creating this sense of the ending of the story may not be what you want, but it's what this story needs, and it is how to best close out a story that has a sense of realism to it, you know. I loved it, but jumping right into it, what I want to talk about the story, and I feel like you have questions about the story, Amy.
Yes and no. Like I stated, Guillermo usually kind of runs the length of creating Gothic fairy tales, which of course original fairy tales or Gothic fairy tales, while being dark, they also serve a purpose of warning. So they balance the macabre with fantasy elements, and something that's Guillermo has done brilliantly and beautifully consistently from what I've seen. And in this, I had not really questions, but my focus shifted initially from Jesus, where we see and it's supposed to be part of his journey, to actually seeing and understanding that my connection balanced more with his granddaughter,
Aurora.
Yes, this in the entire journey, which was even in moments where it was just Jesus and other characters, but not Aurora, I was finding myself continually drawn to her and how his actions were going to end up shaping her. And again, I knew that Kronos, you know, the time, and he was a titan and a god in Rome and blah, blah, blah. But other than that, I really didn't have any idea of what this movie was about. Mm-hmm. So coming at it with fresh eyes really made me question if I had seen this earlier in my progression as an adult, would I have seen it differently? Because my focus, as I was stating, was primarily on Aurora. And I don't know if we're going to spoiler it or not spoiler it. It's an older film, but...
Oh, we're definitely going to spoil. I mean, we're going to talk about the movie. This movie's been out for the last, what, almost 30 years. Next year would be its 30th anniversary. Oh. And looking at, like, even the title of the movie, you know, Kronos itself in Greek mythology was a personification of time. Mm-hmm. So you look at a device that is essentially the Kronos, the embodiment of
time
itself. So to your thought a little bit earlier, but I feel like a lot of this movie really does play heavily on what most people expect to see in, like, typical films like this, like typical vampire movies or typical movies about, you know, somebody searching for, you know, the Fountain of Youth or having it and what its cost is. You know, this is during 1993, so, like, Interview with a Vampire is around this time. You have, you know, just the elements of horror still lingering within everyone's mindset when you think about this movie. So for the fact that it takes a perspective of the common man, if you will, being in that position to being given this gift slash curse and what it requires of them, it's really interesting to see how that juxtaposition plays with what we've seen previously in other films.
Well, and that's also speaking to the point that for me as a viewer, I didn't see this as he was given this gift, this curse. It was almost as if his earnest curiosity in stumbling into it ended up creating like who he becomes later on in the film. I don't know. What do you think, Spencer?
Well, I think that I kind of agree with you. Like, because of Weirdo McGee, who walks into his shop acting all shady. Like, also, like, just pay people decent money to, like, not act weird. Like, and that would have changed this into a completely different movie. because like the whole movie doesn't happen if this guy isn't acting weird in his shop, like tipping him off that there's something he should check out. But yeah, no, I'm blaming this entire movie on this one guy.
The one sketchy guy at the beginning who walks into the shop, who doesn't even say hello, and he's like opening all the packages, looking, and you're like, what are you?
There's no way they're paying him enough to do that.
No, I don't think they are.
I mean, he could be a druggie. He could be somebody who's really needing a fix and gets paid for it. I mean, you never know.
But then that in turn can change the entire story to this is a story about, you know, substance abuse.
Which would make sense for the person who's kind of acting a little bit like a tweaker as he walks into the shop, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That'd also work for Jesus later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the iconic parts of this movie, which you come to recognize, is the scene, I feel like, that kind of embodies more so than any of the other ones, the first actual time where Jesus accepts the Kronos device on his body. The first time it's kind of an accident, but the second time when it's the middle of the night and he's kind of realizing he needs something, and he's even in the fridge. He's looking at, you know, he's drinking tons of water and he looks at this raw meat and he's almost salivating over the raw meat and he realizes that he needs to find the device and he puts the device on him. It does have that kind of sad catharsis sentiment of like a drug user who does put that needle back into them. And even though the pain of the needle hurts, it's the feeling of what happens after the fact of it that you see on his face. And as we progress through the movie, I really do feel like there is a notion to, you know, having family members who struggle with things like that, struggle with drug abuse, struggle with substance abuse, struggle with some type of thing that takes the focus away from the family. And in this case, it was this device that seemed to make him feel good when he would allow it to clutch onto his body tightly to where it made him bleed. You know, as we progress through the movie, every time he uses the device then forward, he doesn't wince as much when he puts it on. He doesn't recognize the pain of when he puts the device on him. It's almost as if he's putting on a tie or he's putting on a watch. It becomes so routine for him that the harm that it does in the instance and the overall, you know, result of using it seem to disappear.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel like with that mentality, like you take a movie from 1993 that it's essentially stinted to be a gothic fairy tale. Mm-hmm. The real world implications of what you were saying at the beginning about how fairy tales have moral lessons out of it, you know, this is one of those movies that, much like that, in that same fashion, does have a moral lesson at the end of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a sad fairy tale. Most of these types of movies don't usually have happy endings, but it's interesting the way somebody can take something like a fairy tale. Like if you had a story about the three little pigs that had this unique parallel to a real world, like economical issue or an issue with a housing problem in the United States or something, like, and there's like a real world moral lesson to, you know, to glean from it. It takes someone really, really unique and very, very kind of out there in terms of creativeness to pen something like that and direct it.
Yeah. And I think in relation to that first time we actually see him, just going back really quickly, there's a big part that we're seeing him take the device, and that he says a prayer, which was something I was like, oh my gosh. But the thing that we failed to mention is that the point of view is from the upper balcony,
mm-hmm.
And he's by the Christmas tree on the stairs, sliding down the stairs, and his granddaughter is watching him do this.
Yeah.
And it just, it's spiraling. Like, yeah. I couldn't, after even the initial time where he accidentally gets it in his hand and she's like kind of freaky, she's like, oh my gosh, are you okay? It shifted my perspective so hard that I couldn't see it from anybody else's point of view for that entire movie. And it became, it made me wonder in what space Guillermo had either seen or experienced something like this, or had knowledge to watch someone struggle with something, whatever it was, that had impacted him in such a way that he wrote about it.
So. Which actually holds water in that, because, you know, Guillermo del Toro did say that this movie was essentially a movie about him in the role of the daughter, because he apparently, I believe he had a grandparent who did, you know, do harmful and self-destructive things to the point where they were no longer in the picture anymore. Mm. No pun intended. And that's also the reason why, like, at the end of the movie, you see a dedication to his grandmother, you know, the one who raised him, because obviously the circumstances they're in, if this is mirroring some sense of his real life, obviously at the end of the film, the grandfather does pass, you know, that could be, you could see it in a couple of different therapeutic ways. Like, number one, he's stating, you know, yes, you know, my grandfather's no longer here, and, you know, I am who I am today because of it. It could also be his final opportunity saying goodbye to that grandparent. Either way, you know, you do see there is a lot of intentionality in the character creation for Aurora and how you see her view the world, which is very unique, because you're seeing somebody ultimately put their body through heck and harm to try to achieve this level of if not immortality, this level of, like, vitality. And you're also seeing the results, the extent of the damage that it causes. And yet, as a child, as a grandchild to these people, you are still wanting to help and assist in them feeling better because you love them. You know, there's a lot that can be said about that alone. Mm-hmm. You know, even to the effect of, like, this movie has the granddaughter ultimately supporting him at every step of the way, being there for him, even when he actually dies and then comes back. Yep. She's there right at the door with the blanket because she heard his voice on the phone when he tried to call the house. You know, it's there is a sense of recognition that as a child, they are so innocent to want to love unabashedly without any regard for themselves, even if it means going, like the character in the film, going to a very dangerous place physically, and, you know, almost being put in, like, a life or death situation, and then come to find out that you may be ended by that grandparent because of the situation. And that's the point where the child has to kind of see where the line is drawn, that fear, that recognition. Even as adults, we have to see that fear, that recognition, that line that should be drawn in the sand.
Yeah.
So, any thoughts, Spencer?
I really liked how, even though Aurora did not have, like, a lot of lines in this movie, she did have a strong impact, mostly because, like, even when she's not the focus of scene, like, they're sure to, like, frame her into the scene.
Yeah.
So that you can definitely see her and see her reactions to things. Yeah. Because, like, like, at that New Year's party, like, she was not happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though she had, like, almost no lines at that entire party.
And it's interesting you bring up that New Year's party, because that is kind of the first instance where we see Jesus kind of fully embrace what he has to do to maintain his hunger, if you will.
Or to sate it even temporarily.
Yeah. The scene is essentially a man. They're at this New Year's party, him, his wife, and their granddaughter. They're at this New Year's party, and he happens to see someone who gets a bloody nose. He immediately recognizes, or maybe even senses, that there is blood somewhere in the vicinity, and ultimately follows this guy all the way up to the bathroom, where he is bleeding all over. He gets his nose under control, leaves the bathroom. Jesus is still in there, sees blood on the counter, and is
tries to get to it.
Well, ultimately, he ultimately lines it up like a Coke person would use a credit card or a razor to line up their Coke for snorting. And it's very interesting that he uses a very unique, like, movements and measurements of where to put this line of blood, if you will, so that he can slurp it up in one quick notion, like any 1980s, you know, director at a cast party or whatever would with Coke in the bathroom. Like, he's lining it up very meticulously because he's going to ingest it. And then someone comes out and washes, like, oh, these New Year's parties always have people like this. Oh, these Peruvians or whatever, like, literally calling out other people. And he wipes down and washes away the blood that was on the counter. And then Jesus notices that there is actually a blood spot on the floor. And he, in the middle of a bathroom, gets on his hands and knees, leans all the way to the floor, and then begins to lick up the blood off of a bathroom floor. Number one, not the most hygienic place you want to be licking anything off the floor, let alone picking up. Number two, he's putting his tongue there, very much noting the depravity of his current state. His hunger has drawn him so much to a situation where he has to ingest this, even if it means picking it up or licking it up, not picking it up, I'm sorry, licking it up straight off the floor.
Well, and then he couldn't even, and the thing I had noted was that it's so quiet when this is happening. You can hear somebody else enter the bathroom, and you can hear the measured steps on the floor and the clicking, and he doesn't stop.
No.
He doesn't turn away. He is literally so engrossed and so undeniably, like, it's bridging spaces of almost ecstasy and delight in what he's doing, that by the time the pair of shoes stops and he looks up, he gets knocked out.
Yeah, and it's too late for that. I really feel like a lot of these scenes are really well created. I mean, we saw, thankfully for what HBO Max offers now, there's like a little insight with Guillermo, and you come to understand like some of the endeavors that he had to undertake to do some of these scenes, like some of the crane shots that he did with the film. This was the first time he said he ever used a crane.
Aww.
And it's done beautifully. You can tell he was like a kid in a candy store with
very
this crane.
Giddy.
And like doing all these cool shots, you know, from above, these sweeping shots that are wide. And it's like, it's all beautiful. It's all done well. It's not haphazardly thrown in there like, we're going to do this. Like, it's not like a Liam Neeson Taken 25 scene, action scene, you know, where there's like 12 takes every second. And that says a lot about the filmmaker in terms of like everything that he's put into this movie, all the scenes that are so aptly put together, so meticulously. It's almost on the level of like Stanley Kubrick, but not to that obsessive of a level where everything in the scene is placed appropriately. It is, you know, measured out at the right length, at the right time, at the right space to create this unique world that looks, number one, lived in, but number two, still has a very strong sense of whimsy.
And then there's Ron Perlman.
And then there's Ron Perlman.
Young Ron Perlman, nonetheless.
I have to appreciate Ron Perlman's, you know, efforts in trying to speak Spanish consistently. For a man who I don't think I've ever seen him speak Spanish in any other film.
I've heard him. Didn't he speak Mandarin in Pacific Rim?
Was he in Pacific Rim?
I thought he was. He was the dealer for down. He was like the. There's something. I'm gonna Google.
You're right. I'm sorry. You're right. He's the guy behind the scenes. You're right. He is in there. The one with the metal shoes.
Shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't remember him having his own mech. But but yes, he was
it
in there.
It would have looked like him. With the cigar.
Like with the flat top and the protruding jaw and the cigar.
And his very large nose.
Which, I mean, you have to give credit to where credit is due. The fact that he tried so hard to, because apparently the character was supposed to consistently speak Spanish. But unfortunately, you know, limitations. And
not Doug Jones.
Not Doug Jones at all. But this is one of those instances where it works. And it adds to that element of that whole spin on the trope, you know, making sure there's still the the level of mockery, if you will, for you know, Mexican folk or Latin folk being always the villain or the you know, the antagonist in films at the time. So I thought his role was really well done. I thought he added a lot to the film, especially for him being so young in his film career. You know, seeing him in this, and then you transition another, like, what, 15 years, and he does Hellboy, and it's like,
so good.
My God, like, his physicality and his ability is still there. And even now, like, I still look forward to, hopefully, God willing, being given the other opportunity for Hellboy 4. I wouldn't mind a Hellboy 4.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because of the David Harbour one.
Yeah. No, yeah, we don't talk about
you
that.
You said 4. There's technically only 2.
Oh, I'm sorry. 3. Sorry. Yeah,
because
Hellboy
there's
3.
Golden Army, and then there's that space that there should be a third one.
Yes, should. Very much so.
There should.
For you guys, was there any other unique character or unique performer that you guys thought really did a unique job in this film?
Spencer?
I mean, I feel like we've talked about the main performers that are like really interesting and creative. Mm. And then you've got apparently the bad guy of Dieter, who I don't know what is happening with this man, but like he's got like machinations just like of getting this device all over the place. And at first it was kind of jarring because like with the low key tone of like everyone else in the movie and then he's just here. So like I kind of get why like, you know, this is his like revenge on Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because like love Robin Perlman, but those two characters are just plain ridiculous.
They are. and it does lend itself to the idea of like, oh, they are definitely comic book type villains. Mm-hmm. Because their whole efforts in this film seem like the coyote and the roadrunner. Like they always seem to be like a step behind.
At the end of the movie, like he's gloating into Jesus's face. It's like, I ate the pages you need. And it's like, you could have done so many other things.
You could have burned them. Yeah. You could have thrown them away. You could have.
I'm sure you have a toilet that just like washed down the toilet.
Could have just ripped them up. Like, yeah. But I think that adds that level of like just ridiculousness to a villain. Like, to someone to go to that length. I mean, honestly, Jesus could be like, all right, when's the next time you got to go? Like, I can just get it from there. Like, it's still obtainable.
Also, this person is now a vampire, and you think they won't just go through you to try to get it?
Oh, yeah.
Super weird.
I mean, you ain't lying.
What about you, Ames?
I want to give... So, most... It's I agree. Dieter was the most oddly placed of the two. Ron Perlman carried enough menace that if he had just been acting alone or for some mysterious benefactor, and then we saw Dieter way on the far side, like he ended up being somewhat Nosferatu-esque, I would have felt more kind of looming dread with that, but I didn't. It's okay. But for giggles, the guy that is the mortician that puts the putty on Jesus's face. So Jesus, after, of course, Ron Perlman, surprise, surprise, whose name is Angel or Angel, however you'd like to pronounce it, he gets pissed off. Jesus will not give him the device, and he pushes his car off a cliff. Good on Ron Perlman. First off, that man legit got down and was like, hut, hut, hike, and ran at that car. Like, dang, bro, you got it. So Jesus is pronounced dead, and they get him to the mortician. And so we see the mortician who is stitching him up.
And well, he's sewing his mouth shut.
Well, and he had also stitched his face to put back some of the skin. Yeah. But then he takes this, it looks like a giant pile of gum.
It does. Yeah.
And he just smacks it on his face. And then he starts doing like that focaccia move. Like if you're making focaccia where you use your fingers and you make it all spongy, he's like doing that to his forehead. And the guy standing behind him goes, oh, you do such beautiful work. And he's like, exactly. It's an art. And he's standing there like rubbing it in for a forehead. And you're like, that ain't a pretty forehead, my dude. But it ends up being like this space for comedic relief that you didn't think you were going to need. To like, you're still kind of concerned. You're like, well, Jesus had the device. He should still be alive. Like, how is this going? And you've got just this mortician that's like, I love my job. I do so good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he even adds some of the comedic elements, like when he thinks that he's put Jesus, while in a wooden box, into the incinerator for cremation. Ron Perlman's character comes into the room, and his the other person who works in that mortuary is like, oh, a friend of the family wants to see, you know, Jesus one more time, you know, before he looks at the oven, and then he looks at him and he goes, medium or well done? And it's like, that was good.
Ha-cha-cha.
And it adds that element of, like you said, brevity in a situation that seems to be consistently just kind of spiraling out of control for Jesus. And having that mortician in there really does lighten, if not much more in a more jovial type mood, but rather in like a comedic type mood.
Yeah.
It's the difference between like having Robin Williams in a scene as opposed to someone like Chris Tucker. Like, you have jovial with Robin Williams, but you have just comedic flair with, you know, Chris Tucker.
But also Robin Williams could do both. Like, that's true. he knew how to balance it. So that is like, that is apples and potatoes, sir.
Apples and potatoes.
Some of them need to be worked over to be more delicious. The other ones are just delicious as they are.
Like gum on the forehead.
Ugh.
Speaking of apples and potatoes, the difference in terms of like recognizing kind of where the basis of the story for the main character in like most vampire films, as opposed to this one, really does set its roots in the design of like the device itself. And which in turn kind of transitions also into the design of what the inside of the device looks like, which is really incredible for its time. The way the workings of the gears work and the way the whole just setup looks, it is very reminiscent of Guillermo's work in Hellboy 2. In the Golden Army, where you see everything is built on cogs and wheels and devices that are turning and the machines itself. And it's almost like Guillermo took the idea with Kronos and that device and amped it up to like 111 in Hellboy. But it's still like the aesthetic of it, the design of it, even the design of, you know, the device on the outside and the color palettes therein that, you know, you have there. it's really cool. And I really like how you take just simple mechanisms and simple, you know, gears and cogs and things like that, and you add like a rich golden color palette on the backdrop of reds and darker colors, and you put it all together and you get essentially a Guillermo del Toro set design. But he's known for working in that type of like color palette, whether if it's deep, rich, warmer tones, or working in like, you know, gothic type 40s color palettes and tones, like with The Shape of Water. You know, I can hear you if you just say.
No, I didn't say Shape of Water. I think what I like so much about, if we're talking about color palette, this is one of the ones for Guillermo that I saw that was, that had balance until we get to the mechanism itself. And then in some spaces we see where there's a color palette design that speaks to the time period.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, especially internally, that when we're seeing the inner workings of the mechanism, the color, the texture, how it feels, it reminded me of a different movie by a different filmmaker called The Fall. Which is plays in very heavily into reds and blues and greens, and it has Lee Pace in it, so you can't be mad at me.
Oh my god!
But it is a breathtaking film, which is actually another play on a gothic fairy tale, because it's taking place with a little girl who's fallen. She's an immigrant girl. She's fallen out of a tree. She's in a hospital, and she's come across this man in a bed who's telling her all these stories. You come to find out the man in the bed is a stuntman, and he's gotten hurt. And he's telling her this wild and like beautiful story. And it's an entire fairy tale. And the movie actually plays out in her mind as a fairy tale, and you get to see it and everything. And it's really cool.
Yeah. Which Tarsem Singh is known for doing that kind of work. The director, He also did part of the screenplay for that, but he also did movies like The Cell with Jennifer Lopez, which
I have seen that.
Which holds a very similar color palette to The Fall in certain instances, not in every scene. But it's very consistent for that director, and it's a very well executed, you know, usage of that color palette.
Yeah, so. and with Guillermo, it's really nice to see, because I have an affinity for warm colors. I like them. I like them a lot. And in this, I wasn't expecting it, to be very honest, because as I've been able to see more Guillermo films, I've noticed how he has been evolving and growing as a director. And going back to the beginning to see where he started, I did not expect to see that those moments so staunchly recognizable in his first film, but it made me appreciate them even more, much like the archetype for Aurora and how she is and her presence and how she carries herself. And knowing that he wrote and directed this makes sense when you're looking at other female protagonists in his other movies and how they're relating.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to be able to look and go, I know what he's doing now, but this is where he started. And the color palette, and especially for internal workings, was just like, that's cool.
And even the design of the bug, the design of the beetle that's inside of that device, it is very reminiscent of his work that he did with Relic in the late 90s, which was another fantastic film about a unique, Mimic. Which is essentially about a bug that is able to manipulate itself into looking like humans or people. Not so much in the way their face looks and everything, but just in the shape so that they can slip by in the shadows. It's a very great movie.
Spencer's are like, no thank you, that bug can stay over there.
And it's about the size, if not bigger than a human. And it's a really great movie.
Spencer and I are like, we're at the bug game hard.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that you have to see.
No.
Because it's so unique and it's so wonderfully done. But the design of the actual creature in that movie lends itself to some of the makings of what we see with this bug, this creature in this film that's inside of the device that we see come to life every time the device is used. You're going wide-eyed over there on me.
I don't want to think about the bug inside the device. Would you agree, Spencer, the bug inside the device looks leechish and not comfortable?
Like, I was hoping someone would take the dang thing apart and
you
just
too?
Look at it.
Right?
What is this? Why have we not seen it?
Smash it on the ground.
And that's interesting that you say that, because there are also elements of this movie that I feel justly, you know, done correctly, that omit certain parts of what you would expect with most fairy tale type stories. Like the explanation of, you've latched on, you've used the device. Do you know there's rules to follow?
Said that part, but then nobody ever told us, which I was like, I wasn't going to get to know these rules.
But what I'm saying, though, is that even though we didn't get those rules, or we didn't get somebody opening the device to see the inner workings of it or any of that, or someone come to like the full fruition of what the device can fully make you become outside of just immortal, like what if there was other elements that outside of just living for forever that you could do, those types of parts of the story, even though they weren't a part of this story, were very much omitted for very specific reasons. And I feel like those specific reasons were they were not fixated points. Mm-hmm. They were not moments to draw your attention towards. Because then if you find, okay, there are three rules you have to follow, or there's three things that you have to know about, you know, using the device, then you become fixated on, did he meet the first goal? Did he meet the second one? Mm-hmm. Did he do the third one? You're fixated on that journey rather than the journey of the man. And then you succumb to just the tasks that are created within the film, or the goals that are set within the film that are not the important part. The important part is the overarching journey of the individual we are seeing. Even though I really do feel like, as much as we are watching Jesus go through this journey, like I've stated earlier, Aurora is the one who we are to be seeing the film through, mm-hmm. more so than anything else. But I wanted to mention that because I know I got a text from you, Amy, who was like, oh, you know, I saw the movie. It was good. But what the heck were those things that he was talking about? What do you mean there was, you know, there's rules or restrictions of this and that?
Because I'm curious by nature, mm-hmm. much like Jesus. I'm not saying I'm getting into drugs.
Thank God.
And I have no access to a life vitality machine. Sorry. I would want to know. And that was the thing, I think, when we first meet Dieter and he's like, after threatening me, like, I know you got that thing. Come see me. I'm open all night. And you're like, Dieter, whoa, my bro, calm down.
I also did not like that message.
No. And then when he gets there and he has the conversation, he's like walking around him. And he gives him a piece of paper that shows him what the scarab looks like and a bug that's next to it. And I wanted to like pause and like stare at that page because the prop work was so beautifully done. But then he's like, oh, there are strict rules and there are things. And I was like, traditional, crazy, you know, villains would start giving you all those details in hopes that you're going to mess up because they miss a step and they're going to come back to you and be like, mm-hmm. you know, I tried your way and it didn't work. And like, oh, you tried my way. Well, let me show you. Ha ha. Shoot him in the head. Like, there's a whole arc that
usually... I was thinking more along the lines of like Aladdin where like, oh, he didn't use the genie, right? But the Jafar did. And I thought you were going in that direction. Nope. I don't remember the scene where Jafar shoots Aladdin in the head and that's the end of the franchise.
That's because Jafar didn't know about guns.
I mean, he could have.
Yeah, that's why he sent him to the ends of the earth. Wee.
Yeah.
So long, ex Prince Ali.
Oh my God. Go ahead.
Going back to prop work, I do agree with you. Like the way they made that book of rules and instructions,
yes.
That like he was just flipping page and then unfolding them. I was like, well, now I want to look at this book because like just the book itself was very interesting.
Yeah,
and I also get what like why the rules weren't the focus of the movies because they would super detract from what he's trying to do with like. Jesus' journey. However, the only thing that really bothered me at the end was like, I know like Jesus was like, oh yeah, I can just lick this blood and be fine. But like at the beginning of the movie, there was another person who was draining a whole person
with
their blood. And I'm like, how much is the escalation of this?
Yeah.
That's the only real.
And I think that's part of that. That's like part of that recognition of that tail end of the movie, recognition of seeing that you are willing to do heinous things in order for you to be sated, mm-hmm. as Amy mentioned. And I think Jesus recognizes that in that moment with his granddaughter, you know, to the point to where she has to call out his name to remind him of who he is and who he is to her, to bring him back to a sense of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's kind of like this moment of clarity for Jesus. Ultimately recognizing that he can't go on doing this. And I feel like that's kind of that redemption point, if you will, for the character in the movie. And honestly, it is a sad ending, but I feel like it's a fitting ending without having all those extras of like rules and whatnot being fed to you. And then you at the end of it being focused like, oh wait, did he actually do the third thing? Wait, was that time he did this thing about that? Was that actually him doing the third thing? And so he's not really dead. He's actually like, then you create this tangled mess of thought process that takes away and like Spencer says, completely detracts from the overall arc and story. And to what Amy said, the moral lesson, if you will, at the end of the film. Wrapping this thing up, do we have any highlights or issues about the film outside of, you know, the information part?
I knew that this was not going to end happily, but I am glad that it ended with Aurora being fine.
Yes.
Because if anything happened to that little girl, I would have freaked out.
I can agree that the sequence where right at the end, her grandfather is turned, she sees he needs blood. And she's just like, I'm going to do this. And you're like, oh, God, no. No, this is going to end super badly. I also found it very interesting that they let him shed his skin and then he went home to die peacefully in bed. That was very interesting. I think my only issue was that one guy with the gum, the mortician with the gum for the forehead, was like, that was a bit perplexing. And then the introduction of Jesus's wife was very interesting, and it felt not like it was second, like an afterthought, but we see her, like, initially you see her at the breakfast table and you're like, oh, it's cute. And then she's like doing a tango class or a dance class, and she's a teacher. And then the next time, like, we kind of see her, her space is downplayed. Like, her importance, it's there, but it bears not as much. It doesn't carry the same type of importance that Aurora did. It doesn't carry the same type of importance as in Pan's Labyrinth, even the bad guy who is her stepfather. Like, the mother and the stepfather had equal footing and balance in Pan's Labyrinth, and in here, we don't really see that between the grandfather and the grandmother. We, like, she's there, and she's going to end up taking care of Aurora, but you're just kind of like,
And I'm pretty sure, like, the I can't say, like, I know the thought process, but in the element of this type of filmmaking, like, maybe not putting so much emphasis on the troubles they're in wouldn't, if there was more emphasis, it would take away from the dynamic and the relationship between him and Aurora.
Yeah,
I feel like the focus wasn't so much on their relationship, but on, in terms of him and his wife, but him and his granddaughter, which is the reason how he is saved at the end of the film, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think one more highlight, just really briefly for me, was the moment where he wakes up after that first intentional use and it's missing. And he goes up to the roof and he knows she has it. And he's frantically looking for Aurora. And he goes up to the roof and he goes into this little shed where she has her toys and where she plays, and she set up tea. And she set up tea and she's hiding behind this blanket that she has over something. You can see her little shoes. And he calms himself down, sits down in the chair to have this conversation. And it was, and he explains that, you know, he had the same thing with his son, where his son had heard about, you know,
lung cancer.
And so he took his cigarettes and he ran off with them, and he ripped them up and threw them in the toilet because he was scared for his dad. And so it is this really well-written but also heartbreaking scene of having an adult to gloss over but also paint that it's okay that I'm getting hurt because it's a little bit of hurt and nothing bad's going to happen to me, to a child, and that it's done in such a, it's done so brilliantly that he pours her a little cup of tea and he hands it to her, and she's still behind the curtain and she stays back there and she drinks her tea and this whole thing. And he's essentially, it has such a great space and acknowledgement for childhood and for the innocence therein. And that all she's trying to do is hide and protect him from the bad thing that can hurt him. And she knows that. And he essentially kind of lures her out with the promise that it'll be okay in the end. And we see that she at the end is willing to make the choice that if grandfather, this is what he needs, I'll give him whatever he needs. That for that split moment when she said, because she didn't have any other words except for the one word at the end, which she said, grandfather, it was the awakening moment where I think he realized that her innocence and that moment where he had tried to gloss over that everything was going to be okay. Like, it went back and it looped back in. And it was so heartbreaking, but it was so well done.
Yeah. Wrapping this whole thing up, I do have a roundtable question for you guys, and it's kind of an interesting one. There was actually once talks about an American remake of the film at one point. Let me finish.
No.
So Guillermo del Toro actually met with Universal at the time in 93, and they told him they wanted to actually buy the rights of the film so they could remake it.
No.
His response was, who wants to see Jack Lemmon lick blood off a bathroom floor?
Ew.
But in the thought that if there was an opportunity to do an American remake done by Guillermo, who would you guys fan cast as the role of Jesus?
William Dafoe.
Oh, that's actually a really interesting one. I would actually want to see that.
Oh. They have to be alive.
Ames.
93, they would have been alive.
We're talking about now.
Oh.
Come on.
Willem Dafoe would scare the snot out of me.
And that's why he's perfect.
Because, well, he was in that one movie. What was it? Whatever happened? Was it Whatever Happened to Monday or Whatever Happened to Wednesday?
Whatever Happened to Monday?
Yeah. It was a like
Netflix show.
It was a Netflix movie. It's based on a book about he's a dad to like all of these.
The clone girls?
The clones.
Thing?
The clones, yeah.
Yeah. I saw
and that was really interesting because he balanced really well as a parent. And it wasn't just Norman Osborn. Oh my gosh. I can't. Yeah, I think that's probably the better one because everything like I'm going through in my brain to try to find somebody who could balance the type of nuance in that role, like I can't and that would have enough draw. That's the other thing. You're looking for people that have draw and then can balance the nuance and the desperation in there without trying to turn it into something it's not. Like I really can't think of anybody.
Really? Mm. Well, let me give you mine. I have two that I would actually really like to see play this role. God willing, they're still around. Just thought process. But the first one I would like to see do this would be Clint Eastwood. I feel like Clint Eastwood has a lot of, there's still a lot in him left to be able to do this role and to really kind of create the nuance of this particular character. You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
Because he would not, as brilliant as that man is, I don't think we would ever get him to the point where he is desperately licking blood off a floor. Like, you have hedged it in such a space that you would have to have somebody that is not only willing, but that would commit to that moment.
Obviously, because there are precautions and safety protocols. They're not going to actually make them lick off the floor.
But I'm talking about that moment, that desperation, that, like, I don't see Clint Eastwood being like, yes, I'm gonna get down and get straight.
For the sake of a journey for the character, I feel like he would. Take, for instance, Gran Torino. Gran Torino is a great film. He ultimately, spoiler alert, gets gunned down by Hmong gangsters. I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's really not a great way to end off a character. But in doing so, for the arc of the character and for the story of the young girl in the film itself, he does that. So I would say, I think he could do it. I think he probably would do it if offered, if he was capable. The only other person that I feel would probably do this well enough, and I believe because of the roles that he's done in the past, he could do this role. He's done everything from, you know, action to horror to straight up just crazy films. Michael Caine. I feel like Michael Caine,
that would be so decrepit and scary.
Mm-hmm. But
he could do it. He could do that. That we put that on your short list.
Yeah.
Like, oof.
Yeah, I feel like Michael Caine could be that type of grandfather figure, number one. And then number two, be able to get to the depths of depravity for that role to the instance where, can you imagine if it was Michael Caine in that last scene with a young girl as opposed to, you know, anyone else for that scene in the recognition of, you know, grandpa, you know, and then totally.
Like, Secondhand Lines was hard enough.
Yes.
And that was, and that's probably one of my favorite movies. But yeah, that's. Oof. Like, I can't, that's my brain. I can't figure out another, like, older Hollywood actor that I would want to see it because my brain was, like, flicking through the Rolodex of younger intense. Because, to be very honest, I do not want to see Denzel Washington do that. He could, but Lord knows we don't want him to. Like, and that's just,
Denzel. No.
He's not depraved. He's brilliant, but he's not depraved.
So there's no one you can come up with?
I wanted Raul Julia, but that's not going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen
exactly.
At all.
Exactly. Yeah, see, and that then my brain was like, Carl Urban? No. John Boyega? He's not an old man, but he could do it. Yeah, my brain was like filtering through other people, and then I just can't, man. Like, I don't want to see Brendan Fraser with his comeback try to do this. That would just hurt my heart.
No.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't have anything good. There are no good brains coming out of this brain.
Well, then, Spencer, you got another actor that maybe we can fill in the role for Amy, since she can't think of nothing.
This is a lot harder because, like, Willem Dafoe just came to me.
Then that's the thing. Like, the first one that comes to you is usually the one you're like, yes, this one.
I feel like I could see this done also with possibly, just because, again, knowing the movies that he's done previously and the depths to which he's capable of doing performances for the sake of the overall story in the film, I'd be open to seeing Patrick Stewart do it as well.
See, I had put that in my head and I was like, I don't want to see him do that. That's like, because the other one was Sir Ian McKellen, and I was like, he could, because he started kind of shifting into this, like, the scarier, not the scarier, but the more villainous roles, not including Magneto, because Magneto's just awesome. But that's, see, like, we're looking for older Hollywood, and we're looking for people that can kind of parallel or give us not only that good grandpa energy, but then they're just like, they're going to twist and nope.
Well, moving forward and wrapping this thing up, since Amy can't think of a thing, let's go ahead and go around the table and see how the film passes or fails and how many monocles. I want to go ahead and start with Spencer.
Okay, this movie passes for me. It was a really great watch, especially with not knowing anything about it. I think that's kind of the best way to watch it, unfortunately. Yeah. Because, like, just that turn of, like, it's actually about vampires. I was like, amazing. So, yeah, great watch.
Amazing. Yeah,
I had a fun time watching this movie. So, yeah, 5 out of 5. Like, hey. Highly recommend.
Definitely. What about you, Ames?
So this film passes for me. I really liked Dang with Spencer. It was awesome. It was such a heartbreaking yet beautiful representation of time, vitality, innocence. Like, it captured everything that I love about a fairy tale in such a true sense, which is coming or is becoming part of things that I love about Guillermo del Toro's work. So yeah, I definitely recommend it. If you don't have HBO, borrow somebody's HBO. And if you can't do that, go to the library and rent Kronos, because it's in the Criterion Collection. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5 as well.
Nice. Very nice. This movie is one of those types of films that helps me recognize why I love cinema in the first place, and its unique storytelling with great performances and a beautiful script. We talked about several times on this episode or on this show about the trifecta of great movies, and it's great performances, great direction, great acting. You know, it's simple, and it's just the clear, concise way to hit a home run. And this movie does exactly that. This movie's writing, everything was so on par with what I wanted to see with a Guillermo del Toro movie, and I loved it. So it passes for me. And in terms of monocles, it definitely gets a 5 out of 5. This movie is very much a story about the relationship between two people and the young innocents who are hurt in the event of family members or loved ones doing destructive behavior. So I love this movie. I highly recommend you go and check it out. It is on HBO Max. And yeah. But that about wraps up another awesome episode of the show. Remember, you can check us out wherever podcasts are streaming. That's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into wherever your heart's desire and listen to our show. Look up The Filmlosophers. Give us a 5-star review. Let us know that you like the show or you have thoughts. We'd love to hear you. You can also check us out over on our website at filmlosophers.com. There we got over allegedly 300 episodes, everything ranging from romance to action to comedy to even conversations about the industry. We have everything there. You can check us out. filmlosophers.com. We are also on the socials. We are at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. Check us out there. We post as often as we can often drop little segments. We will be doing more segments of Jane on Scene as well as Spencer's Baked Score throughout this month. So take a listen. Watch out for those. Those will be dropping on the socials. Like I said, this is one of those movies that really does take a turn from what you would come to expect as the typical vampire movie, and you recognize that it's more than that. And I think one of the most enigmatic scenes that really highlight that is when you have the scene of a now dead and decaying Jesus rising out of a toy box as night comes, where his daughter is sitting by, his granddaughter is sitting by with a candle. So if ever there was a scene that highlighted that the most, it's that scene, as well as other great scenes. You got to check this out. Check it out on HBO Max, or you can rent it or stream it wherever you can. So, but like I said, that wraps up another great episode, and we hope to see you soon next week. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm still intern Amy, I think.
Yeah, I think so far. Class dismissed.